What does Australia's next generation of young leaders have to say about the future of India-Australia relations in a post-COVID world? And how do Indian scholars, scientists, practitioners, and students factor in? You're listening to Shared Visions, the podcast that spotlights the Australian government's new Colombo plan and gets to the heart of these questions. Today, we speak with Michael Murdocca, a student of Politics and International Relations from the University of New South Wales, and Siddhi Mishra, a consultant with gender budgeting with the Ministry of Women and Child Development in India.
Hi, my name is Siddhi, and I am currently working as a consultant with the Ministry of Women and Child Development in the gender budgeting division. So basically, my background is of sociology and then a master's in gender studies. And right after my master's, I did my first job actually with the Center for Equity and Inclusion, where I was a program officer for communications and advocacy. So one of my roles also, like one of my duties, responsibilities, I would call it, was also maybe to, you know, look for interns or to see who wants to actually be a part of our institution or our organization, who would actually want to work for the empowerment of women. So in May, I got an email from Michael that he's part of the new Colombo plan. And that, you know, he would like to do an internship with us. So that's when we first connected. And August, he had joined the organization. Unfortunately, I had already left the organization at that time when he interned. So I think about the internship, I would like to shift over to Michael right now about his experience.
My name's Michael. I did the new Colombo Plan program in about 2018 and 2019. So that's the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Australia. So basically, I decided to undertake the program because I really wanted to learn more about Australia's place within the region and the geopolitical issues that stem from that. I have a strong interest in Asia and Australia's role within the Asia Pacific. And so basically what this program allowed me to do was to visit different countries within the Asia Pacific. My host destination was in Japan, but I spent a lot of time in India, Myanmar, and some other places. And when I was in India, I had such a great time because I had the chance to really delve into the sort of issues that are pertinent to Indian society. And then part of that was by working with SEQIN, which focuses on gender equality within India, specific to that context. And so basically, it was a really profound experience because I learned a lot about the relationship between Australia and India, the issues to do with women within the country specifically. And what it did is made me aware that SEQIN really is a socially important non-governmental organization that seeks to promote the notion that women should have equal opportunities to men. And, you know, they advance this concept by exploring options to reduce domestic violence, enable women to develop their capabilities by having autonomy over their own resources and decision-making, and democratic participation and inclusion. So that resonates with me. And I really think that what I did in India extended beyond that. I spent a lot of time within the north of India traveling. And I learned a lot about the significant spirituality, religious underpinnings within the country, as well as my role as a citizen within Australia to help foster better relations between our nations.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you had a really like kind of holistic experience or a holistic understanding of these issues in India. But yeah, tell me a bit more about, I guess from the both of you, I'd like to hear about the day-to-day at SEQIN, like what kind of work were you doing, Michael, like when you were an intern at the organization? And then Siddhi, if you could just expand on, largely what are the goals and what kind of work on the ground does the organization do?
Yeah, so SEQIN plays a really important role, I think, because basically what I gained from SEQIN was a really newfound appreciation for the the potential for organizations to work well and organize at the grassroots. So empower ordinary people within India to lobby, you know, play a role in shifting social attitudes for the benefit of a wider cause. And, you know, this is an NGO with perhaps limited resources, and they rely on people to spread their mission. And this proves to me the role of empathy and understanding as the best tools to combat polarization and cynicism and build trust in key institutions. So basically, I had the chance to work on a number of different programs. Sekwen has a few. So there's Batte Kadam, which is a program that's it's supported by the UN and other bodies like the British Council. And it allows Sekwen to work with women and girls from vulnerable communities to ensure that they have a fair level of education and training and that they can participate actively within the economy. So they focus on self-reliance and self-sufficiency among women. And they do this through assisting with, say, social entrepreneurship initiatives and workshops, financial literacy programs. And I had the chance to participate in one of these programs in a place called Mewat. I attended a session in a small primary school. I learned a lot about R.A. Ambedkar while I was there, who is a significant figure within India. And I had the chance to talk directly with the young girls at that primary school about the role that they can play within India in fostering better relations with Australia, but also encouraging India's growth into the 21st century. And I also had the chance to get involved in a program called Kickstart Equality. So this is actually supported in part by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Australia. And I participated in this program in the Jamia Nagar office. So basically, I witnessed a lot of young girls participating in the program. So they're from disadvantaged and conservative communities. They get involved in football so they can build self-confidence and leadership. And I think this is important so that we can encourage women to be great leaders. And there's also a women's resource center, from my understanding, that Sekwen works with. But the main program that I worked with was a program called Mado Walibat, which focuses on ensuring that we can create a respectful environment for people of men and women. And what this requires is getting men involved in talking about specific issues that women face so that we can create an awareness around them. And it involves changing behaviors. So one of the things that I noticed was that we had a roundtable discussion with a lot of the young boys in different communities so that they can talk directly about their responsibility to work on issues to end violence against women. So yeah, there's a lot of work that Sekwen does, and it's really important within the context of India to tackle issues like malnutrition, sexual assault and domestic violence, and illiteracy, among others.
Siddhi, would you like to, did you have anything to add to that?
So when I started working with Sekwen, it had basically, we started with four main projects. That is, as Michael mentioned, Mardo Wali Baat, Kickstart Equality, Women Resource Center, and Batte Kadam. So even if I want to briefly add on to what each project says, Batte Kadam, as again Michael mentioned, it was based on social entrepreneurship. We had skilling courses for women and girls in Jamia Nagar. We started off in Jamia Nagar, and then we spread on to Mewat in Haryana. So in Jamia Nagar, there is a separate field office where we had our beauty and our tailoring courses. And that's where Batte Kadam comes in. Kickstart Equality was a football for girls project, which also actually started with the direct aid program of the Australian High Commission. And it was actually a very successful project because we saw that young girls from the age of 5 wanted to change their lifestyle and not lead a typical stereotypical lifestyle of that of a woman as a household or a domestic worker. They wanted to shift their interest from maybe tailoring and cooking to football, which was actually a very good thing. And then we had these agents of change, or the champions that whom we call, who were these elder girls, they used to train, they have become football coaches now. So they used to train these younger girls. So again, we had that sort of a setup in Jaminagaran as well. When we expanded this project to Mewat, again, in the Kasturba Gandhi Balaka Vidyalayas of the districts in Mewat, we saw that the girls were really enthusiastic to play football. And so in the region of Mewat, you would often see that the uniform is of a dupatta and a proper dupatta and a kurta. So we all know it's very difficult, you know, to play with the dupatta because it keeps flying off or it might get stuck in your leg. So we actually saw after months of having interactions with them, they would keep their dupatta aside, they would play their football and then they would wear them back again. So, you know, we just that thought also that it came to them automatically, that was very it was very encouraging for us as well. And then I think Mardowali Baat, as Michael mentioned, is actually to bring in the concept of men to realize that they are also a big part in empowerment of women, how they can become the champions to maybe empower the community around them. And this is actually not a very easy task because we often see, like I have seen since my younger days, that it's clearly explicitly visible that, you know, there are some differences between men and women, and it does come up in daily life. It's not, we will not explicitly say it, but yeah, in our routines, if I'm going out, if I'm coming back in, you do see it. But these boys whom we had with us, they were really, they emerged as champions, and you know, it's really wonderful to see. So I think if Michael wants to expand more on that project, he can. And lastly is about the Women Resource Center. So basically that was, it was something like a safe space for women to come into our office to deal with their, maybe if they had a domestic dispute at home or if they had some issues, if they wanted to work, if their husband was not working or had maybe passed away and they had wanted to start working again, they would come to our office to, you know, for advice, for suggestion, to seek counsel, basically. So those were our four main projects at that time.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I'm curious, you know, having explained like all of these different functions of Sequin, you know, you mentioned when you wrote to us that you are a consultant for the Ministry of Women and Development for the gender budget. And I'm actually curious if you could just expand a bit on what that work kind of entails and what that looks like.
So basically, when I was hired by the ministry, I was placed in this division. And frankly, at first, I didn't know what it was. Gender budgeting is an emerging concept in India. And it although the government of India passed this in 2005, it has recently started picking up. So the concept is, we all know that budgets are right now not equally allocated towards both men and women. What we are advocating for is, like, in every sector, in every ministry, you need to allocate some part of your budget towards women and girls as beneficiaries. So maintain a gender equality. So that's what we do right now. We are advocating, we are enhancing basically gender budgeting in other ministries by telling them that maybe you can report on these programs of your ministry. And similarly, we do it in states as well. So the states come up with their own gender budget statement in which they tell us, you know, how much of the budget has been allocated in which sector for women. And we also recently have started seeing an actual expenditure which is being done for these women and girls. So, and all of this actually is a public document.
Oh, wow. Okay. And yeah, I wasn't even sure that that was, you know, like an explicit allocated function of the Ministry of Women and Development. So it's interesting to hear that there's even a move towards that. But I get, you know, you began with saying, you know, frankly, when you started, you didn't know what it was about and stuff. But How long have you been doing it, and you know, kind of what is your confidence level about this arm of governance in India? Do you feel that it's moving in a positive direction, or do you feel like there's still so much of an uphill battle to fight?
I guess if we talk about the empowerment of women, or maybe gender equality also, it's always going to be an uphill battle for some time now. But yes, during the past 2 years when I worked with the ministry, we have done several works and we have had several achievements. So I do see it, because since we are engaging with different stakeholders at this time, that's one. We are enhancing gender budgeting in ministries. We have expanded it to the states as well. So there is, it will pick up, of course. But yeah, the thing is, what we have learned in our graduation and our post-graduation is that India has dealt with patriarchal relations for a very long time. So to change that, of course, it will take time. This is one tool that we, gender budgeting is one tool that we use. So of course, it will take time. So for the near future, I'm not sure if we will want to say that we have attained gender equality, but yes, we are working towards attaining gender equality.
So Michael, you know, having come into this context as a student from Australia, obviously, as we kind of touched on, the whole concept of gender equality in India, it's obviously quite a bit more complex and multifaceted than it would be in a developed country like Australia. You kind of came in with an eagerness to learn and an eagerness to participate in these communities. And, from the sound of it, you really got to the heart of what it was, or you really tried to engage on a grassroots level. What kind of perspective did you kind of gain from it? What did you take back to Australia?
Yeah, so I think that the challenges within the context of India, they demonstrate the interrelationship between the issues that exist across all different societies and the role that we can play as citizens to help further our institutions to ensure that all people can participate actively within them, that we can respect people's rights, that their innate potential to participate and engage in society. So I think that it comes back to that basic premise, which is that all of us have certain inalienable rights, and that it's the responsibility of citizens to work together at a grassroots level by voting, by participating in democratic structures to help ensure that all of us can progress through the world and can have our innate identity respected. I think that if I were to look at it on a personal level, I would say that my experiences within India have sort of shaped my identity, because, you know, when I was there, I was probably only about 22 at the time, and I'm still only a couple of years older. But basically, as a young man who's trying to understand my place within the world, I feel that I had the chance to really become more aware of different issues, particularly within that context, but also connected to spirituality, connected to different belief systems and ways of life, being aware of evolving social and economic challenges that exist within a country like India. And I think that it strengthened my understanding of, the fact that I was doing a new Colombo Plan program, and that this is what education should be about, the ability to see things from new perspectives, to understand issues from another person's standpoint, and I think also to cultivate a curious and critical mind. So in a sense, by participating in a grassroots institution within India, but also traveling through the diverse states that exist within the north of India, I feel that my values have been strengthened, and that I'm always encouraged to think constantly about the big picture, including how what I'm doing in my career can help to further opportunities to strengthen the bonds that exist between people of different backgrounds. And connected to that, I think that the relationship between Australia and India on a broader level can be one of the strongest and deepest partnerships within the 21st century. And I say this because, from my perspective and from what I saw on the ground, basically India and Australia share common bonds. And I think that this allows us to share in each other's opportunities and successes while also building a more safe and secure region and world. And I think these include faith in democracy, economic development, preserving international security through, say, a rules-based order. And basically, one, I just want to stress that when I was in India, I had a little book with me. It was about the history of India. And as I traveled to every destination, I read little bits and pieces which made me more aware about the country's past and also what it signifies about the opportunities that Australia and India can build together. And I think that whether that's been the work of leaders that strive for independence and arrived in 1947, or the ability for politicians such as Prime Minister Nehru to carve out a constitution, enact ambitious social and economic reforms, or the opening up of the country's economy in 1991. Reading about all of these developments made me more aware about the resilience of the Indian people and the values that it's so intertwined with Australia. So as I go throughout my career, I'm going to be mindful of that and aware of the potential of our two countries to foster good relations with each other.
Right, right. And I really like what you said about, you know, the importance of working at, like, the importance of working on issues like these, which often are overlooked, at least when you're talking about the broader relationship between two countries. You know, I think, like, the ground reality of something like gender equality or something like gender empowerment, it's, you know, one might not frame that as something that concerns India-Australia strategic relations and such, but I think on a peer-to-peer level, on a personal relationship level, I mean, those things really go a long way. And also, you know, working on the ground, there's so much you can learn in terms of collaboration and sensitivity and working, you know, working with communities that, you know, is applicable across the board. So that's really good to hear. But what you mentioned last is actually a great segue into my next question, which is kind of about, sure, you know, how you guys think, you know, this kind of work connects to the relationship between our two countries. Because, you know, there's a lot of, it's kind of discussed quite extensively now, especially with the new strategic partnership. And Michael, even when you wrote to us, you talked about your interest in cybersecurity and kind of the cyberspace being a huge avenue of collaboration between the two countries, which is also another arena where I see gender equality kind of playing out in an interesting way. So just from both of you, I'd like to hear a little bit about that. Just tell me about, you know, what you think, how this work, you know, you think it connects broadly to the relationship between India and Australia.
Yeah, so, I mean, to start, there's a whole... there's different elements to this. So we can look at strategic and defense policy. We can look at, you mentioned cybersecurity, including technological cooperation. We can look at other areas, including economics or international education. But I think to start off more broadly, you know, like Australia, I think I want to go back to that, those shared principles, because I think, you know, India, it's a democracy. In fact, the world's largest democracy. And I really think this provides India, you know, the basis to take a leadership role in the world by promoting the notion that, you know, the will of human beings should play a role in shaping the political decisions of states. And I think that Australia and India understands that this provides a system and a framework for the protection of human rights and freedoms, ability for citizens to express their thoughts and perspectives, hold representatives to account. So, guided by this basic understanding, look, I think that India can work closely with Australia to promote that, including in the developing world, and because these principles, they shape the identity of all nations. But basically, in terms of cybersecurity, I think that these are really complex issues, particularly within a landscape that's changing. The technological landscape is changing constantly. And I think that ultimately, if we have a look at the different frameworks and agreements that have been developed, this connects closely with the strategic objectives of Australia and India. You know, for instance, if we have a look a little bit at the bilateral relationship, it's characterized by a commitment to work together to invest in new technologies. These include quantum computing, AI, And this shows that I think the bilateral relationship is trending towards cyber resilience, technological advancement. And I think that this also connects to steps to protect critical infrastructure. It connects to the focus of a strategic partnership built on cooperation in defense science technology. But basically, my interest in cybersecurity, I guess, stems from I'm writing a thesis at the moment on the topic, particularly connected to trade law, because my background is law, and I've had the chance to do a bit of research in the area. But basically, India and Australia signed a framework for cyber and cyber-enabled technology cooperation only a couple of months ago. And I think that that's focused on making sure that we have rules and standards around cybersecurity that advances the public good. And basically, I think that's a key aspect of policy within India and Australia. But, you know, there's a whole lot of other elements of strategic and defence cooperation. These include the mutual logistics support agreement, which was signed, allows the countries to use each other's military bases for logistical purposes. It involves, you know, I think Prime Minister Modi has a Make in India initiative, which allows Australia to partake in it. His decision was to enable that, and you know, there's other areas as well that I can discuss. But I guess that's a general framework for that. Yeah.
So I feel what Michael said was really on point, and of course, in any relationship between India and Australia is beneficial to both countries. We both can learn from our social development structure or our infrastructure development. And maybe, of course, we can implement some policies that would help the citizens of both nations to come together. And especially in this post-COVID times, it is mostly needed now that, you know, that we all come together to maybe create some sort of an alliance or a policy that would, again, benefit the economy, of course, but also help the citizens and the people to get back on their feet, whatever they have lost, and not in terms of just financial gain. I'm talking about the time that they have lost, the efforts that they might have had put in during the 6 to 7 months. So definitely, I think we can work on some alliance.
Yeah, I think. Just to sort of conclude, I would love to hear from Michael, if you could just tell me a bit about, just a few words about, you know, why you would see value in a cultural exchange program like this, and, you know, what the potential benefits could be for, you know, scholars and students and practitioners, not just in Australia, but also in India, you know, kind of facilitating that exchange.
Well, of course. Well, I think the main thing that I got out of the New Colombo Plan program was an awareness of how different cultures can have similarities, the differences, but ultimately the bonds that we share as human beings from different countries are actually quite similar. You know, we have more in common than we think, and we can learn a lot from each other because we have different traditions and different ways of life. But ultimately, if we focus on the things that we have in common, the common values and common ideals that we share, then that can form a basis for a framework between our peoples to achieve great things. And I think that, you know, the great thing about that I'd like to say in terms of Indian students who are looking to come to Australia, for instance, is that, that, you know, Australian universities are particularly, I think, looking at attracting the best and brightest to Australia. And it's basically international education is Australia's biggest service export to India. And I think that I've had the chance to work across with many Indian students within my university, and I know that they're very diligent and conscientious and getting the most out of their education. So basically, the fact is that when you do a cultural exchange, you get to understand people's different skills and abilities. You get to learn more about how the identities between peoples can form a framework for cooperation. And I think that ultimately that is a great asset for countries, but it's also a great asset for yourself because you learn a lot about about different ways of life, about economic structures within countries, and about how to be empathetic and tolerant of different worldviews. So I think that that is a great reason to get involved in a program like the New Colombo Plan or international education more broadly, because it helps to expand your worldview and be more critical and aware of injustice or different issues that exist between different societies.